deaths during his quest. He had no further intention of being restrained by the law, or even the code of Batman.
Last chance to live, Lucius. Ethically speaking, your life was bought and paid for the day you committed your first atrocity for the Death Eaters. You're still human, and your life still has intrinsic value, but you no longer have the deontological protection of an innocent. Any good person is licensed to kill you now, if they think it'll save net lives in the long run, and I will conclude as much of you, if you begin to get in my way. Whoever sent the troll after Granger must have targeted you too and hit you with some curse that makes former Death Eaters melt into a pile of goo. Very sad.
Father, Draco said in a small voice, I think you should consider it, Father.
Lucius Malfoy looked at his son.
You jest. It's true. I don't think Potter just made up his books. Nobody could have written all that, and there were things in them that I could check for myself. And if even half of that is true, he's right. 100,000 galleons won't mean much. If we give it to him, he really will be friends with House Malfoy again. The way he thinks of being friends anyway. And if we don't, he'll be our enemy, whether it's in his own interests or not. He'll just go after you. Harry Potter really does think like that. It's not about money to him. It's about what he thinks is honour.
Harry Potter inclined his head, still smiling.
But let's get one part of it straight, Draco said, now staring directly at him. There was a fierce light in his eyes. You wronged me, and you owe me.
Acknowledge, Harry said quietly. Conditional on the rest of it, of course.
Lucius Malfoy opened his mouth to say, who knew what, and then closed it again.
Mad, he said again.
There was a long father and son argument during which Harry managed to keep his mouth shut. When it seemed that even Draco wouldn't be able to persuade his father, Harry spoke up again and proposed his intended next steps, if the houses of Potter and Malfoy could cooperate. Then came more argument between Lucius and Draco, during which Harry again stayed silent. Finally, Lucius Malfoy's eyes turned to gaze at Harry.
And you believe, Lucius Malfoy said, that you can persuade Longbottom and Bones to go along with this notion, even if Dumbledore opposes it?
Harry nodded.
They'll be suspicious of your involvement, of course, but I'll tell them that it was my plan to start with, and that should help.
I suppose. Pose,
Lucius Malfoy said after a pause,
that I could have a contract drawn up, absolving you of almost all the remaining debt, if by some chance I do go along with this mad idea. It shall need more guarantees, of course.
Harry promptly reached into his robes and drew out a parchment, unfolding it and spreading it across the golden table.
"I've taken the liberty myself, actually,"
Harry said. He'd spent some careful hours in the Hogwarts library with the law books available. Thankfully, so far as Harry could tell, the laws of magical Britain were charmingly simple by Muggle standards. Writing that the original blood debt and payment was cancelled, the potter's wealth and all other vault items would be returned, and the remaining debt annulled, all with no fault to the Malfoys, was only a few more lines than it took to say out loud.
I had to promise my keepers not to sign anything you gave me, so I made sure to compose this myself and sign it before I left.
Draco emitted a choked laugh. Lucius read through the contract, smiling humorlessly.
How charmingly straightforward. I also promised not to touch a quill while I was in Gringotts, Harry said.
He reached into his robes again and drew out a Muggle pen along with a sheet of normal paper.
Will this wording be all right?
Harry rapidly scribbled down a legal-sounding statement to the effect that House Potter didn't hold House Malfoy responsible in any way for Hermione Granger's murder, and didn't believe that they had anything to do with it, then held up the paper in the air for Lord Malfoy's inspection. Lord Malfoy looked at the paper, rolled his eyes, and said,
"Good enough, I suppose. Though to have the proper meaning, you should use the legal term indemnify rather than exonerate. Nice try, but no. I know exactly what that word means, Lord Malfoy."
Harry took his parchment and began copying down his original wording more carefully. When Harry was done, Lord Malfoy reached across the golden table and took the pen, looking at it thoughtfully.
"One of your Muggle artifacts, I suppose. What does this do, son?"
"It writes without needing an inkwell," Draco answered.
"I can see that. I suppose some might find it an amusing trinket."
Lucius smoothed the parchment contract over the table, then set his hand by the line for signatures, tapping the pen thoughtfully on the starting spot. Harry wrenched his eyes away, up to Lucius Malfoy's face, forcing himself to breathe regularly, not quite able to stop his muscles from tensing.
"Our good friend, Severus Snape," said Lucius Malfoy, still tapping the pen on the line awaiting his signature. "The defense professor, calling himself Quirrell. Now I ask again, who is your third suspect, Harry Potter?"
"I would strongly advise that you sign first, Lord Malfoy, if you're going to do so anyway. You will benefit from this information more if you do not think I'm trying to persuade you of something."
Another humorless smile.
"I shall take my chances. Speak, if you wish this to continue."
Harry hesitated, then said evenly,
"My third suspect is Albus Dumbledore."
The tapping pen stilled on the parchment.
"A strange allegation,"
Lucius drawled.
"Dumbledore lost much face when a Hogwarts student died within his tenure. Do you suppose that I will believe anything of him, only because he is my enemy?"
"He is one suspect among several, Lord Malfoy, and not necessarily the most plausible. But the reason I was able to kill a full-grown mountain troll was that I had a weapon which Dumbledore gave to me at the start of the school year. It's not strong evidence, but it's suspicious. And if you're thinking that murdering one of his students is not Dumbledore's style, well, the same thought had occurred to me."
"It's not his style?" Draco Malfoy said.
Lucius Malfoy shook his head in a measured, careful movement.
"Not quite, my son. Dumbledore is particular in his evils."
Lord Malfoy leaned back into his chair, then sat quite still.
"Tell me of this weapon." "I'm not yet certain I should go into details about that in your presence, Lord Malfoy."
Harry took a breath.
"Let me be clear on this. I'm not trying to sell you on the idea that Dumbledore is behind this, raising the possibility."
Then Draco Malfoy spoke.
"The device Dumbledore gave you, was it something to kill trolls? I mean, just trolls. Can you tell us that?"
Lucius turned his head to look at his son with some surprise.
"No,"
Harry said slowly.
"It wasn't specifically a sort of anti-troll slaying or anything like that."
Draco's eyes were intent.
"Would the device have worked against an assassin?" "Not if they had shields raised." "No. A fight in school? An expanding rock in the throat is inherently lethal. No, I don't think it was meant for use against humans."
Draco nodded.
"So, just magical creatures. Would it have been a good weapon against an angry hippogriff, or something like that?" "Does the stunning hex work on hippogriffs?"
Harry said slowly.
"I don't know," said Draco. "Yes," said Lucius Malfoy. "Compared to trying to target a Wingardium Leviosa and a Finite Incantatum, then a stunning hex would be a better way of dealing with a hippogriff."
Put that way, it did seem increasingly like a transfigured rock was an optimal weapon only against a flesh-and-blood magical creature with spell-resistant skin.
But, it might not have been intended as a weapon at all. I used it in a strange way. It could have just been a crazy whim." "No,"
Lucius Malfoy said lowly.
"Not a whim. Not coincidence. Not Dumbledore." "Then it's him,"
Draco said. Slowly, Draco's eyes narrowed, and he gave a vicious nod.
"It's been him since the beginning. The court's legilimens said that someone had used legilimency on Granger. Dumbledore admitted that it was him, and I bet the wards did go off when Granger cursed me, and Dumbledore just ignored them. But,"
Harry said. He looked at Lucius, wondering if it really was to his advantage to question this idea.
"What would be his motive? Are we going to say he's evil and leave it at that?"
Draco Malfoy jumped out of his chair and began pacing around the room, black robes swishing behind the young boy, the goblin guards staring at him in some surprise through their enchanted goggles.
"To figure out a strange plot, look at what happens, then ask who benefits. Except that Dumbledore didn't plan on you trying to save Granger at her trial. He tried to stop you from doing that. What would have happened if Granger had gone to Azkaban? House Malfoy and House Potter would have hated each other forever. Of all the suspects, the only one who wants that is Dumbledore. So, it fits. It all fits. The one who really committed the murder is Albus Dumbledore."
Harry said.
But why give me an anti-troll weapon? I said it was suspicious. I didn't say that it made any sense.
Draco nodded thoughtfully.
Maybe Dumbledore thought you'd stop the troll before it got Granger, and then he could blame Father for sending it. A lot of people would be very angry if they thought Father had even tried to do something like that in Hogwarts. Like Father said, Dumbledore must have lost face when people found out that a student had actually died in Hogwarts. Being safe is what Hogwarts is famous for. So that part probably wasn't supposed to happen.
Harry's mind involuntarily flashed back to the horror in Dumbledore's eyes when he'd seen Hermione Granger's body.
Would I have gotten there in time if the Weasley twins hadn't had their magic map stolen? Could that have been the plan? And then, though Dumbledore didn't know it, somebody stole their map, and I was too late. But no, that doesn't make much sense. I found out too late. How could Dumbledore have guessed that I'd use a broomstick? Well, he did know I had one.
There was no way a plan like that could work. And it hadn't. But someone going a little bit senile might expect it to work, and a phoenix might not know the difference.
Or,
Draco Malfoy continued, still pacing energetically,
maybe Dumbledore had an enchanted troll around, and he expected you to defeat it some other time, for some other plot, and then he used the troll on Granger instead. I can't imagine Dumbledore had this all planned since the first week of lessons.
I can imagine,
Lucius Malfoy said in low tones.
I have seen such from Dumbledore.
Draco nodded decisively.
Then I was never supposed to die in the first plot. Dumbledore knew Professor Quirrell was checking on me, or Dumbledore planned to have someone else find me in time. I couldn't have testified against Granger if I was dead, and he'd have lost face if I'd died. But my leaving Hogwarts and not being around to lead Slytherin would be just right for him. And then, the next time, Harry was supposed to stop the troll before it got Granger, and everyone was supposed to blame you, Father. Only that time, it didn't go the way Dumbledore planned.
Lucius Malfoy lifted his grey eyes from where he'd been gazing with open surprise at his son.
If this is true, but I wonder if Harry Potter is only playing at being reluctant to believe it.
Maybe, Draco said, but I'm pretty sure he isn't. Then, if it is true...
Lucius Malfoy's voice trailed off. A slow fury was lighting in his eyes.
What would we do, exactly?
Harry said.
That, too, is clear to me,
Draco said. He whirled on them and raised a finger high in the air.
We shall find the proof to convict Dumbledore of this crime and bring him to justice.
Harry Potter and Lucius Malfoy looked at each other. Neither of them quite knew what to say.
My son,
Lucius Malfoy said after a time,
truly, you have done very well this day.
Thank you, Father. However, this is not a play. We are not aurors, and we do not put our trust in trials.
Some of the light went out of Draco's eyes.
Oh.
I do have a sentimental fondness for trials," Harry interjected. "I cannot believe I'm having this conversation."
He needed to go home and take a sheet of paper and a pencil and try to figure out whether Draco's reasoning actually made sense.
"And evidence?"
Lucius Malfoy turned his gaze to Harry Potter then, and his eyes simmered in pure grey fury.
"If you have deceived me,"
Lucius Malfoy said in tones of low anger,
"if all this is a lie, then I will not forgive. But if this is not deception, bring me the proof to convict Dumbledore of this murder before the Wizengamot, or evidence enough to have him cast down, and there is nothing that House Malfoy will not do for you, Harry Potter. Nothing."
Harry took a deep breath. He needed to sort all this out and figure out the actual probabilities, but he didn't have time.
"If it is Dumbledore, then removing him from the game board leaves a huge hole in Britain's power structure."
"So it does,"
Lucius Malfoy said with a grim smile.
"Did you have any ambitions of filling it yourself, Harry Potter?"
"Some of your opposition might not like that. They could fight."
"They will lose,"
Lucius Malfoy said, now with a face hard like iron.
"So, this is what I'd want House Malfoy to do for me, Lord Malfoy, if Dumbledore gets removed because of me. When the opposition is most frightened, that's when they'll be offered a last-minute arrangement to avoid a civil war. Some of your allies might not prefer it, but there'll be a lot of neutrals who'll be glad to see the stability. The bargain will be that, instead of you taking over right away, Draco Malfoy will take power when he comes of age."
"What?"
Draco said.
"Draco has testified under Veritaserum that he tried to help Hermione Granger. I bet there'd be a lot of people in the opposition who'd take a chance on him rather than fight. I'm not sure how exactly you'd enforce it, unbreakable vows or Gringotts contracts or what, but there'll be some sort of enforceable compact about power going to Draco after he graduates Hogwarts. I'll throw any support the boy who lived has behind that bargain. Try to persuade Longbottom and Bones and so on. Our first plan paves the way for that later, if you're careful to act honourable when you deal with Longbottom and Bones this time around."
"Father, I swear I didn't..."
Lucius's face twisted into a grim smile.
"I know you didn't, son. Well..."
The white-haired man stared across the mighty golden table at Harry Potter.
"Those terms are acceptable to me, but fail in any part of our agreement, whether our first bargain or the second, and there shall be consequences for you, Harry Potter. Clever words will not halt that."
And Lucius Malfoy signed the parchment. Mad-Eye Moody had been staring at the bronze door of the Gringotts meeting room for what seemed like hours, insofar as a man could stare at any one thing when his gaze always saw in all directions. The trouble with trying to be suspicious of a man like Lucius Malfoy, Moody thought, was that you could spend an entire day thinking of everything he might be up to and still not have finished. The door cracked open, and Harry Potter trudged out, small beads of sweat still on his forehead.
"Did you sign anything?"
Mad-Eye demanded upon the instant. Harry Potter looked at him silently, then reached into his robes and drew out a folded parchment.
"The goblins are already executing this," said Harry Potter. "They made 3 copies before I left."
"Merlin, damn it, son!"
Moody paused as his eye caught sight of the second half of the document as Harry Potter slowly, as though reluctantly, began to unfold the top upward. A glance sufficed to take in the paragraphs drawn in careful handwriting, Lucius Malfoy's elegant signature below Harry Potter's. And then Moody exploded, even as the top half of the document also began to enter his sight.
"You exonerate House Malfoy in any involvement in Hermione Granger's death? Do you have any idea what you've done, you little fool? Why, in Merlin's name, would you do something like... what?"
Chapter 98. Rolls Final. Sunday, April 19th, 6:34 p.m. Daphne Greengrass walked quietly toward the Greengrass room below the Slytherin dungeons, the privilege of an ancient house. On her way to drop off her trunk from the Hogwarts Express before she joined the other students for dinner. The whole private area had been hers alone ever since Malfoy had gone. Her hand, held behind her, made repeated come-along gestures at her huge emerald-studded trunk, which seemed hesitant to follow. Maybe the enchantments on the sturdy old family device needed to be reapplied, or maybe her trunk was reluctant to follow her into Hogwarts, which was no longer safe. There'd been a long talk between mother and father after they'd been told about Hermione, with Daphne hiding around a doorway to listen, choking back her tears and trying not to make sounds. Mother had said that the sad fact was that if only one student died every year, well, that still made Hogwarts safer than Beauxbatons, let alone Durmstrang. There were more ways for a young witch to die than being murdered. Beauxbatons' transfiguration master just wasn't on the same level as McGonagall, Mother had said. Father had soberly remarked how important it was for the Greengrass heir to stay at Hogwarts, where all the other noble families sent their children to school. It was the reason for the old tradition of the noble families synchronizing the birth of their heirs to put them in the same year of Hogwarts, if they could. And Father had said that being heiress to a most ancient house meant you couldn't always stay away from trouble. She could have done without hearing that last part. Daphne gulped hard as she turned the doorknob and opened the door.
"Miss Greengrass,"
whispered a shadowy, silvery-robed figure. Daphne screamed and slammed the door and drew her wand and turned to run.
"Wait!"
cried the voice, now higher and louder. Daphne paused. That couldn't possibly be who it had sounded like. Slowly, Daphne turned and opened the door again.
"You!"
Daphne said in astonishment as she saw the face beneath the hood.
"I thought you were..."
"I've come back to you now,"
the silvery-robed figure said in a strong voice.
"At the turn of the..."
"What are you doing in my bedroom?"
shrieked Daphne.
"I heard you can cast the mist form of the Patronus charm.
Can I see?"
Daphne stared, and then her blood began to burn.
"Why," she said, keeping her wand level, "so you can kill everyone in Slytherin who casts un-Slytherin spells? We all know who it was that had Hermione killed."
The figure's voice rose.
"I testified under Veritaserum that I tried to help Miss Granger. I really was trying to help her when I grabbed her hand on the roof. When I helped her off the floor."
Daphne kept her wand level.
"Like your father couldn't tamper with the Aura's record if he wanted to. I wasn't born yesterday, Mr. Malfoy."
Slowly, as if not to cause alarm, the silver-robed figure drew a wand from his robes. Daphne's hand tightened on her own wand, but then she recognized the position of the fingers on the wand, the stance the figure was assuming, and she drew a shocked breath.
"Expecto Patronum!"
Silver light leapt from the end of the other's wand and condensed, forming a shining serpent that seemed to coil in the air as though nesting there. She just gaped.
"I did try to help Hermione Granger," Draco Malfoy said with a level voice. "Because I know the sickness at the heart of Slytherin's house. The reason why so many of us can't cast the Patronus charm anymore is hate. Hate of Muggle-borns, or just anyone, really. People think that's all Slytherin is about now. Not cunning, or ambition, or honourable nobility. And even I know, because it's obvious if you just look, that Hermione Granger wasn't weak at magic."
Daphne's mind had gone completely blank. Her eyes darted around nervously, just to check that there wasn't blood coming from under the doors, like the last time something had broken.
"And I've also figured out," Draco Malfoy said quietly as the silver snake went on shining with unmistakable light and warmth, "that Hermione Granger never really tried to kill me. Maybe she was false memory charmed. Maybe she was legitimized. But now that she's been murdered, it's obvious that Miss Granger was the target in the first place, when somebody tried to set her up for murdering me."
Do you know what you're saying?"
Daphne's voice broke. If Lucius Malfoy heard his heir saying that, he'd skin Draco and turn him into trousers. Draco Malfoy smiled, metallic robes gleaming in the light of his full corporeal Patronus. It was a smile both arrogant and dangerous. Like being turned into a pair of leather pants was beneath his concerns.
"Yes," said Draco. "But it doesn't matter now. House Malfoy is returning House Potter's money and cancelling the debt."
Daphne walked over to her bed and then fell on it, hoping she could wake up from the dream once she was in bed.
"I'd like you to join a conspiracy," said the figure in the shining robes. "Everyone in Slytherin who can cast the Patronus charm, and everyone who can learn. That's how we'll know to trust each other when the silvery Slytherins meet."
With a dramatic gesture, Draco Malfoy cast back his hood.
"But it won't work without you, Daphne Greengrass. You and your family. Your mother will negotiate it with Father. But I'd like the Greengrasses to hear the proposal from you first."
Draco Malfoy's voice lowered grimly.
"There is much we need to speak of before we eat dinner."
Harry Potter had apparently taken to being invisible. They'd glimpsed his hand only briefly when he was handing them the list, written on strange, not parchment. Harry had explained that, all things considered, he didn't really think it was smart for him to be findable, except on special occasions. So he was just going to deal with people as a disembodied floating voice from now on, or as a brilliant silver light that hid behind corners where nobody could see it, and which could always find his friends no matter where they tried to hide. It was, in all honesty, one of the creepiest things which Fred and George had ever heard, over a lifetime which had included filling the shoes of every student in second-year Slytherin with transfigured live millipedes. Fred and George didn't think this could possibly be good for anyone's sanity, but they didn't know what to say. It couldn't be denied. They'd seen with their own four eyes that Hogwarts wasn't safe.
"I don't know who you went to for the false memory charm on Rita Skeeter," said the sourceless voice of Harry Potter. "Whoever it is, probably won't be able to fill this order directly, but they may know someone who can get things from the Muggle world. And I know it may cost extra, but as few people as possible should know that Harry Potter is related to this."
Another flash of a small boy's hand and a bag hit the ground with the clinking noise.
"Some of these items are expensive, even in the Muggle world, and your contact may have to go outside Britain. But 100 galleons will be enough to pay for it all, I hope. I'd tell you where the galleons came from, but I don't want to spoil tomorrow's surprise."
"What is this stuff?"
said Fred or George as they looked over the list.
"Our father is a Muggle expert."
"And we don't recognize half this stuff."
"Why, we don't recognize any of it.
Just what are you planning to do?"
Things have become serious," Harry's voice said softly. "I don't know what I'll have to do. I may need the power of the Muggles, not just the wizards, before this is done. And I might need it right away, with no time to prepare. I'm not planning to use any of this. I just want it around in case of contingencies."
Harry's voice paused.
"Obviously, I owe you more than I can ever repay, and you won't let me give you any of what you deserve. I don't even know how to say thank you properly. And all I can do is hope that someday, when you grow up, you'll be more sensible about this whole thing, and would you please take a 10% commission?"
"Shut up, you,"
said George, or Fred.
"For goodness sake, you went after a troll for me, and Fred had his ribs broken."
They both just shook their heads. Harry had stayed behind when they'd told him to run, and stepped forward to distract the troll from eating George. Harry was the kind of person, they knew, who'd think that something like that didn't cancel out what he owed the Weasley twins, that his own deed wasn't properly commensurate. But what the Weasleys knew, and Harry wouldn't understand until he was older, was that it meant that nothing was owed, or even could be owed between them. It was a strange kind of selfishness, they thought, that Harry could understand kindness within himself, never dreaming of asking of money from anyone he'd helped more than they'd helped him, or calling that a debt, while being apparently unable to conceive that others might want to act the same way toward him.
"Remind me to buy you a copy of the Muggle novel Atlas Shrugged," the sourceless voice said. "I'm starting to understand what sort of person can benefit from reading it."
Monday, April 20th, 7 p.m. It happened without any intervention or sign from the head table, as the students had finished their subdued dinner. It happened with no permission or forgiveness asked from the professors or the headmaster. Shortly after the dessert dishes had appeared, a student stood up from the Slytherin table and calmly made his way, not to the front of the head table, but toward the opposite side of the four tables of Hogwarts. A few whispers broke out at the sight of the white, blonde, short-cropped hair as Draco Malfoy stood there, silently regarding all of Hogwarts. Draco Malfoy had said almost nothing since his return. The Slytherin had condescended neither to confirm nor deny that he had returned because, with Hermione Granger dead at his family's hand, he no longer had anything to fear. Then Draco Malfoy took up a spoon in one hand and a glass of water in the other, and began tapping, producing a clear ringing sound. It produced more excited babble at first. At the head table, the various professors looked in puzzlement toward the headmaster in his great chair. But the headmaster gave no sign, and so the faculty did nothing. Draco Malfoy continued tapping the spoon upon his glass until the room fell silent, waiting. Then another student arose from the Ravenclaw table and made his way to where Draco Malfoy was standing, turning to face Hogwarts at his side. Breaths were drawn in surprise. Those two should have been the bitterest of enemies.
"I and my father, the Lord of the noble and most ancient house of Malfoy," Draco Malfoy said in a clear voice, "have come to realize that there are ill forces at work in Hogwarts. That these ill forces did wish Hermione Granger harm. That Hermione Granger was perhaps compelled, against her will, to raise her hand against our house. Or perhaps she and I were both memory charmed. We now say that whoever dared use the heir of Malfoy so is the enemy of House Malfoy, upon whom we shall have our vengeance. And that honour be served, we have returned all monies taken from House Potter and cancelled all debt." Then Harry Potter spoke. "House Potter acknowledges that it was an honest mistake and holds House Malfoy no ill will. We believe and publicly say that House Malfoy was not at fault in Hermione Granger's death. Whoever harmed Hermione Granger is the enemy of House Potter, upon whom we shall have our vengeance. Both of us." Then Harry Potter began to walk back to the Ravenclaw table, and the babble of sheer, utter reality-crashing bewilderment began to explode. Draco Malfoy resumed tapping his spoon against his water glass, creating a clear, ringing chime. And other students arose from other tables, making their way to where Draco Malfoy stood, arranging themselves at his side, or behind him, or before him. There was a dread silence in the great hall, a sense of the world shifting, of realigning powers, almost tangible in the air.
"My father, Owen Greengrass, with the consent and full backing of my mother, the Lady of the Noble and Most Ancient House of Greengrass,"
Daphne Greengrass spoke.
"And my forefather, Charles, of the House of Knot," said the former Lieutenant Knot, once Theodore of Chaos,
now standing behind Draco Malfoy.
"And my great-aunt Amelia, of the House of Bones, also director of the Department of Magical Law Enforcement," said Susan Bones, who stood next to Daphne Greengrass, beside whom she had fought.
"And my grandmother, Augusta, of the noble and most ancient House of Longbottom,"
said Neville Longbottom, who had returned for this one night.
"And my father, Lucius, the Lord Malfoy, of the noble and most ancient House of Malfoy.
Together with Alana Howe, constituting a majority of the Hogwarts Board of Governors,"
Daphne Greengrass said clearly,
"have, to ensure the safety of all students, including their own children, passed the following educational decrees upon the Hogwarts School of Witchcraft and Wizardry." "First,"
Daphne said. Daphne was trying to keep her trembling under control as she faced the four houses at the forefront of the five. There was only so far her parents' lessons in speech-making could take her. Daphne's eyes darted down quickly to her hand, upon which, written with a quill in faint red ink, cues to her lines had been written.
"Students are not to go anywhere alone, not even to the toilets. You will travel in groups of at least three, and every group must have a sixth-year or seventh-year student."
"Second,"
Susan Bones said from behind her, voice almost firm.
"To further ensure the students' safety, 9 auras have been dispatched to Hogwarts to form an auxiliary protective force."
Susan took a small, round glass object from within her robes, one of the communicators that the DMLE used, which they'd all been given. Susan raised it to her mouth and said, her voice now higher,
"Aura Brodsky, this is Susan Bones. Enter."
The doors to the hall slammed open, and in marched 9 auras in the reinforced leather gear they used when on duty. At once they spread out, 2 auras taking up station by each of the 4 tables, and the last took up watch at the head table. There were more gasps.
"Third,"
said Draco Malfoy, his voice commanding. Malfoy had apparently memorized his own lines, since there was nothing written on his hand that Daphne could see.
"In the face of a common enemy who does not balk at killing students from any house, the 4 houses of Hogwarts must come together and act as one. To emphasize this, the house point system is temporarily suspended. All professors will encourage solidarity between houses by decree of the Hogwarts Board of Governors."
"Fourth,"
recited Neville Longbottom,
"all students not already in the defense professor's after-school classes will receive special training in self-defense by aura instructors."
"Fifth,"
Theodore Knott yelled in a menacing tone,
"all fighting in the corridors or anywhere outside of defense lessons will be dealt with severely. Fight together or don't fight at all."
"Sixth,"
said Daphne Greengrass, and took a deep breath. When she'd found out what was planned, she'd made her own little extra request to Mother through the flu. Even with Lucius Malfoy going along with Amelia Bones, a thought her mind was still having trouble grasping. The Greengrass swing vote had still been vital, since Jugson and his own faction had refused to back Malfoy. Not to mention that Bones didn't trust Malfoy, and Malfoy didn't trust Bones. So, Mother had demanded, and the Greengrass had received.
"Since memory charms have been used on students without setting off wards, it is possible that someone on the Hogwarts faculty may be implicated. Therefore, the Auxiliary Protective Force reports directly to my father, Lord Greengrass."
And this part was only symbolic, she knew. There'd be no reason anyone wouldn't just contact the Aurors directly. But it might turn into more someday, which was why she'd asked Mother to demand it.
"And if anyone wants to report something to the Auxiliary Protectors, they can talk to the Aurors, or go through me."
Daphne's arm swept behind her to indicate the gathered students.
"The duly appointed president of the Auxiliary Protective Special Committee."
And Daphne paused dramatically. They'd all rehearsed this part.
"We don't know who the enemy is," said Neville, whose voice did not squeak.
"We don't know what the enemy wants," said Theodore, still looking menacing.
"But we know who the enemy is attacking," said Susan, as fierce as when she'd taken on 3 seventh-year students.
"The enemy is attacking Hogwarts students," said Draco Malfoy, clear and commanding, like all this was his natural element.
"And Hogwarts,"
spoke Daphne of Greengrass, feeling her blood burn like it never had before in her life,
"is going to fight back."
Chapter 99. Rolls, Aftermath. 10 days later, the first dead unicorn was found in the Forbidden Forest. Chapter 100. Precautionary Measures, Part 1.
May 13th, 1992.
Argus Filch's face appeared twisted in the light of the oil lamp he held, shadows dancing over his face. Behind them, the doors of Hogwarts quickly receded, and the dark grounds moved closer. The track they now walked was muddy and indistinct. The trees, branches formerly bare with winter, were not yet fully clad with spring. Their branches stretched up toward the sky like lean fingers, skeletons visible amid the thin foliage. The moon was bright, but clouds scudding across it often threw them into darkness, lit only by the dim flames of Filch's lamp. Draco kept a firm grip on his wand.
"Where are you taking us?"
said Tracy Davis. She had been caught, along with Draco, by Filch, on their way to an attempted meeting of the Silvery Slytherins after curfew hours, and likewise given a detention.
"You just follow me," said Argus Filch.
Draco was feeling rather annoyed with the whole affair. The Silvery Slytherins ought to be recognized school business. There was no reason why a secret conspiracy shouldn't have permission to meet after curfew, if it was for the greater good of Hogwarts. If this happened one more time, he'd talk to Daphne Greengrass, and Daphne would talk to her father, and then Filch would learn the wisdom of looking the other way where Malfoys were concerned. The lights of Hogwarts Castle had diminished in the distance when Filch spoke again.
"I bet you'll think twice about breaking a school rule again, won't you?"
Filch turned his head away from the lamp so that he could leer at the 4 students following him.
"Oh, yes. Hard work and pain are the best teachers, if you ask me. It's just a pity they let the old punishments die out. Hang you by your wrists from the ceiling for a few days. I've got the chains still in me office. Keep 'em well oiled in case they're ever needed."
"Hey,
Tracy said, a touch of indignation entering her voice.
I'm too young to hear about that. That sort of... You know, especially if the chains are... well, oiled.
Draco wasn't paying attention. Filch simply wasn't in Amicus Carrow's league. Behind them, one of the two older Slytherins following them snickered, though she didn't say anything. Beside her was the other, a tall boy with a Slavic cast to his face, and who still spoke with an accent. They'd been caught for some unrelated offence, having to do with the type of thing Tracy went on about, and looked to be in their third or fourth year.
"Pheh," said the taller boy.
"In Darmstrang, they hang you upside down by your toes. By one toe, if you're insolent. Hogwarts was soft, even in the old days."
Argus Filch was silent for around half a minute, as though trying to think of a proper rejoinder, and then gave a chuckle.
"We'll see what you say about that when you learn what you'll be doing tonight."
"I said I'm too young for that sort of thing," said Tracy Davis. "It has to wait until I'm older."
Ahead of them was a cottage with lighted windows, though the proportions seemed wrong. Filch whistled, a high, sharp sound, and a dog began barking. From the cottage stepped forth a figure, making the trees seem too short around it. The figure was followed by a dog that seemed like a puppy by comparison, until you looked at it apart from the taller silhouette and realized the dog was huge, more like a wolf. Draco's eyes narrowed before he caught himself. As a silvery Slytherin, he wasn't supposed to be prejudiced against any sentient being, especially not where other people might see him.
"What's this?"
said the figure in the loud, gruff voice of the half-giant. His umbrella lit up with a white glow, brighter than Filch's dim lamp. In his other hand he held a crossbow. A quiver of short bolts was strapped to his upper arm.
"Students serving detention," Filch said loudly. "They're to help you search the forest for whatever's been eating 'em."
"The forest,"
gasped Tracy.
"We can't go in there at night."
"That's right," said Filch, turning from Hagrid to glare at them. "It's into the forest you're going, and I'm much mistaken if you'll all come out in one piece."
"But,"
said Tracy,
"there's werewolves, I've heard, and vampires, and everyone knows what happens when there's a girl and a werewolf and a vampire all at the same time."
The huge half-giant was frowning.
"Argus, I had in mind you and maybe a few servants here. There's not much point in bringing along help if I'm to watch over 'em the whole time."
Argus's face lit with cruel satisfaction.
"That's their lookout, isn't it? Should have thought of them werewolves before they got in trouble, shouldn't they? Send them out alone. I shouldn't be too friendly to 'em, Hagrid. They're here to be punished, after all."
The half-giant gave a massive sigh. It sounded like a normal man having all the air driven out of his lungs by a bludgeoning hex.
"You've done your bit. I'll take over from here."
"I'll be back at dawn," said Filch. For what's left of 'em.
He added nastily, and he turned and started back toward the castle, his lamp bobbing away in the darkness.
"Right then," said Hagrid. "Now listen carefully, 'cause it's dangerous what we're gonna do tonight, and I don't want no one taking risks. Follow me over here a moment."
He led them to the very edge of the forest. Holding his lamp up high, he pointed down a narrow, winding earth track that disappeared into the thick black trees. A light breeze blew over Draco's head as he looked into the forest.
"There's summit in there has been eating unicorns,"
the huge man said. Draco nodded. He distantly remembered hearing something along those lines a couple of weeks ago, toward the end of April.
"Did you call us to track a trail of silvery blood to a wounded unicorn?"
Tracy said excitedly.
"No,"
said Draco, though he managed to stop the reflexive sneer.
"Filch gave us the detention note at lunch today. At noon. Mr. Hagrid wouldn't wait that long to find a wounded unicorn. And if we were looking for something like that, we'd look in the day when it's bright. So..."
Draco held up a finger, like he'd seen Inspector Leon do in plays.
"I infer that we're looking for something that only comes out at night."
"Aye," said the half-giant, sounding thoughtful. "You're not what I expected, Draco Malfoy. Not what I expected at all. And you'd be Tracy Davis, then. I've heard of you. One of poor Miss Granger's lot."
Rubeus Hagrid looked over at the two older Slytherins, peering at them in the light of his glowing umbrella.
"And who'd you be again? I don't remember seeing much of you, boy."
"Cornelia Walt," said the witch. "And this is Yuri Yuli,"
indicating the Slavic-looking boy who had spoken of Durmstrang.
"His family is visiting from the Ukrainian lands, so he's in Hogwarts just for the year."
The elder boy nodded, a faintly contemptuous cast on his face.
"This is Fang," Hagrid said, indicating the dog.
The five of them set off into the woods.
"What could be killing unicorns?"
Draco said after they'd walked for a few minutes. Draco knew a bit about dark creatures, but he couldn't remember anything that was said to prey on unicorns.
"What sort of creature does that? Does anyone know?"
"Werewolves,"
said Tracy.
"Miss Davis," Draco said, and when she looked at him, he silently pointed a finger up at the moon.
It was waxing gibbous, but not yet full.
"Oh, right," said Tracy.
"Nowhere's in the forest," said Hagrid. "They're plain wizards most of the time, remember. Couldn't be wolves either. They're not fast enough to catch a unicorn. Powerful magical creatures, unicorns are. I never knew one to be hurt before."
Draco listened to this, thinking about the puzzle almost despite himself.
"Then what is fast enough to catch a unicorn?"
"Wouldn't have been a matter of speed," Hagrid said, giving Draco an indecipherable glance. "There's no end to the ways that creatures hunt. Poison, darkness, traps.
imps as can't be seen or heard or remembered, even while they're eating your face. Always somewhat new and wonderful to learn."
A cloud passed over the moon, casting the forest into shadow, lit only by the glow of Hagrid's umbrella.
"Myself," Hagrid continued, "I think we might have a Parisian hydra on our hands. They're no threat to a wizard. You've just got to keep holding them off long enough, and there's no way you can lose. I mean, literally, no way you can lose so long as you keep fighting. The trouble is, against a Parisian hydra, most creatures give up long before. It takes a while to cut down all the heads, you see."
"Bah," said the foreign boy. "In Durmstrang, we learn to fight Buckholz hydra. Unimaginably more tedious to fight. I mean, literally, cannot imagine. First years, not believe us when we tell them winning is possible. Instructor must give second order, iterate, until they comprehend."
They walked for nearly half an hour, deeper and deeper into the forest, until the path became almost impossible to follow because the trees were so thick. Then Draco saw it. Thick splashes on the roots of trees, gleaming a brighter colour beneath the moonlight.
"Is that
unicorn's blood?"
Hagrid said. The huge man's voice was sad. In a clearing ahead, visible through the tangled branches of a great oak, they saw the fallen creature, splayed, beautiful and sad upon the ground, the dirt around her shining moon silver with pooled blood. The unicorn was not white, but pale blue, or appearing so beneath the moon and night sky. Her slender legs stuck out at odd angles, obviously broken, and her mane spread across the dark leaves, green-black but with a sheen like pearls. On her flank was a small white shape like a starburst, a centre surrounded by 8 straight rays. Half her side had been ripped away, the edges ragged like the marks of teeth, bones and inner organs exposed. A strange choking sensation rose in Draco's throat.
"That's her,"
Hagrid said, his sad whisper as loud as a normal man's voice.
"Just where I found her this morning. Dead as a doorknob. She is, was, the first unicorn I ever met in these woods. I called her Alicorn. Not that it matters to you any more, I suppose."
"You named a unicorn Alicorn?"
said the older girl. Her voice was a bit dry.
"But she doesn't have wings,"
Tracy said.
"An alicorn's a unicorn's horn," Hagrid said, now louder. "Don't know where you all started thinking it meant a unicorn with wings. There's no such thing I ever heard. It's just like naming a dog Fang,"
indicating the huge, wolf-like dog that barely came to his knees.
"What you would have called her? Anna, or some such? I gave her a name as would have meant something to her. Common courtesy, I call it."
Nobody said anything to this, and after a further moment, the huge man gave a sharp nod.
"We'll start our search from here, the last place it struck.
We're gonna split into two parties and follow the trail in different directions. You two, Waltz and Yuli, you go that way, and take Fang. There's nothing that lives in the forest to lure ya, if you're with Fang. Send up green sparks if you find something interesting, and send up red sparks if anyone gets in trouble. Davis, Malfoy, with me.
The forest was black and silent. Rubeus Hagrid had dimmed the light of his umbrella after they'd set out, so that Draco and Tracy had to steer themselves by the light of the moon, not without occasional trips and falls. They walked past a mossy tree stump, the sound of running water speaking of a stream somewhere close by. Now and then a ray of moonlight through the branches above lit a spot of silver-blue blood on the fallen leaves. They were following the trail of blood toward where the creature must have first struck the unicorn.
"There are rumours about you," Hagrid said in a low voice after they'd walked for a while.
"Well, they're all true," Tracy said. "All of them."
"Not you," Hagrid said. "Did you really testify under Veritaserum that you tried to help Miss Granger? 3 times it was."
Draco weighed his words for a while, and finally said,
"Yes."
It wouldn't have done to appear too eager to claim credit. The huge man shook his head, his great feet still stomping silently through the woods.
"I'm surprised, to be honest. And you too, Davis, trying to put the halls in order. Are you sure the sign hat put you in the right place? There's not a single witch or wizard who went bad who wasn't in Slytherin. So it's always been said."
"That's not true," Tracy said. "What about Xiaonan Tong, the Black Raven, Spencer of the Hill, and Mr. Cavon?"
"Who?" said Hagrid.
"Just some of the best dark wizards from the last 2 centuries,
Tracy said.
"They're probably the best from Hogwarts who weren't from Slytherin."
Her voice fell, lost its enthusiasm.
"Miss Granger always told me I should read up on anything I..."
"Anyway," Draco said quickly, "that's not really relevant, Mr. Hagrid. Even if..."
Draco worked it around in his head, trying to translate the difference between probability of Slytherin given dark and probability of dark given Slytherin into non-scientific language.
"Even if most dark wizards are from Slytherin, very few Slytherins are dark wizards. There aren't all that many dark wizards, so not all Slytherins can be one."
"Or, as Father had said, while any Malfoy should certainly know much of the secret lore, the more costly rituals were better left to useful fools like Amicus Carro."
"So, you're saying," Hagrid said, "that most dark wizards are Slytherins, but..."
"But most Slytherins are not dark wizards," Draco said.
He had a weary feeling they'd be at this a while. But, like fighting a hydra, the important thing was to not give up.
"I never thought of it that way,"
the huge man said, sounding awestruck.
"But, well, if you're not all a house of snakes, then why..." "Get behind that tree!"
Hagrid seized Draco and Tracy and hoisted them off the path behind a towering oak. He pulled out a bolt and fitted it into his crossbow, raising it, ready to fire. The three of them listened. Something was slithering over dead leaves nearby. It sounded like a cloak trailing along the ground. Hagrid was squinting up at the dark path, but, after a few seconds, the sound faded away.
"I knew it," Hagrid murmured. "There's summat in here that shouldn't be."
They went after where the rustling sound had come from, with Hagrid in the lead and Tracy and Draco both gripping their wands at the ready. But they found nothing, despite searching in a widening circle with their ears strained for the faintest sound. They walked on through the dense, dark trees. Draco kept looking over his shoulder, a feeling nagging him that they were being watched. They'd just pressed a bend in the path when Tracy yelled and pointed. In the distance, a shower of red sparks lit the air.
"You two, wait here!" Hagrid shouted. "Stay where you are! I'll come back for you!"
Before Draco could say a word, Hagrid spun and crashed away through the undergrowth. Draco and Tracy stood looking at each other until they heard nothing but the rustling of leaves around them. Tracy looked scared, but trying to hide it. Draco was feeling more annoyed than anything else. Apparently, Rubius Hagrid, when he had formed his plans for tonight, had not spent even 5 seconds visualizing the consequences if something actually went wrong.
"Now what?"
said Tracy, her voice a little high.
"We wait for Mr. Hagrid to come back."
The minutes dragged by. Draco's ears seemed sharper than usual, picking up every sigh of the wind, every cracking twig. Tracy kept looking up at the moon, as though to reassure herself that it wasn't full yet.
"I'm..."
Tracy whispered.
"I'm getting a little nervous, Mr. Malfoy."
Draco thought about it a bit. To be honest, there was something. Well, it wasn't that he was a coward, or even that he was scared. But there had been a murder at Hogwarts, and if he'd been watching himself in a play, having just been abandoned in the Forbidden Forest by a half-giant, he would currently feel like yelling at the boy on stage that he should... Draco reached into his robes and took out a mirror. Tapping the surface showed a man in red robes who frowned almost immediately.
"Aura Captain Ineash Brodsky,"
the man said clearly, causing Tracy to start with the loudness in the quiet forest.
"What is it, Draco Malfoy?"
"Put me on 10-minute check-in," Draco said. He'd decided not to complain directly about his detention. He did not want to look like a spoiled brat. "If I don't respond, come get me. I'm in the Forbidden Forest."
Inside the mirror, the Aura's brows rose.
"What are you doing in the Forbidden Forest, Mr. Malfoy?" "Looking for the Unicorn Eater with Mr. Hagrid," Draco said, and tapped the mirror off,
putting it back in his robes before the Aura could ask anything about detentions or say anything about serving it without complaining. Tracy's head turned toward him, though it was a little too dim to read her expression.
Thanks, she whispered.
The few leaves which had emerged on their branches rustled as another, colder breeze blew through the forest. Tracy's voice was a little louder when she spoke again.
"You didn't have to,"
she said, now sounding a little shy.
"Don't mention it, Miss Davis."
The dark silhouette of Tracy put her hand to her cheek, as though to conceal a blush that wasn't visible anyway.
I mean, not for me.
No, really, Draco said. Don't mention it. At all.
He would have threatened to take out the mirror and order Captain Brodsky not to rescue her, but he was afraid she would consider that flirting. Tracy's silhouetted head turned from him, looked away. Finally, she said, in a smaller voice,
"It's too soon, isn't it?"
A high scream echoed through the woods, a not quite human sound. The scream of something like a horse. And Tracy shrieked and ran.
"No, you numbskull!"
yelled Draco, plunging after her. The sound had been so eerie that Draco wasn't certain where it came from, but he thought that Tracy Davis might, in fact, be running straight toward the source of that eerie scream. Brambles whipped at Draco's eyes. He had to keep one hand in front of his face to shield them, trying not to lose track of Tracy, because it seemed obvious that, if this was a play, and they got separated, one of them was going to die. Draco thought of the mirror, secured within his robes, but he somehow knew that if he tried to take it out, one-handed, while running, the mirror would inevitably fall and be lost. Ahead of them, Tracy had stopped, and Draco felt relieved for an instant, before he saw another unicorn lay on the ground, surrounded by a slowly widening pool of silver blood, the edge of the blood creeping across the ground like spilled mercury. Her coat was purple, like the colour of the night sky, her horn exactly the same twilight colour as her skin, her visible flank marked by a pink star blotch surrounded by white patches. The sight tore at Draco's heart, even more than the other unicorn, because this one's eyes were staring glassily right at him. And because there was a blurring, twisting form, feeding on an open wound on the unicorn's side, like it was drinking from it. Draco couldn't understand, somehow couldn't recognize what he was seeing. It was looking at them. The blurring, seething, unrecognizable darkness seemed to turn to regard them. A hiss came from it, like the hiss of the deadliest snake which ever had existed, something more dangerous by far than any blue crate. Then it bent back over the wound in the unicorn and continued to drink. The mirror was in Draco's hand, and it remained lifeless as his finger mechanically tapped at the surface over and over. Tracy was holding her wand now, saying things like,
"Prismatis,"
and
"Stupefy,"
but nothing was happening. Then the seething outline rose up, like a man rising to his feet, only not so, and it seemed to scuttle forward, moving with a strange half-jump across the dying unicorn's legs, approaching the two of them. Tracy tugged at his sleeve, and then turned to run. Run from something that could hunt down unicorns. Before she could take three steps, there came another terrible hiss, burning his ears, and Tracy fell to the ground and did not move. Somewhere in the back of his mind, Draco knew that he was about to die, even if the aura checked his mirror this very instant. There was no way anyone could get here fast enough. There was no time. Running hadn't worked. Magic hadn't worked. The seething outline came closer, while Draco tried in his last moments to solve the riddle. Then a blazing silver ball of light plunged out of the night sky and hung there, illuminating the forest as bright as daylight, and the seething outline leapt backward, as though in horror of the light. Four broomsticks plunged out of the sky, three auras with bright, multicolored shields, and Harry Potter holding his wand aloft, seated behind Professor McGonagall within a larger shield.
"Get out of here!"
roared Professor McGonagall. An instant before, the seething thing gave forth another terrible hiss, and all the shielding spells winked out. The three auras and Professor McGonagall fell off their broomsticks and dropped heavily to the forest floor, lying motionless. Draco couldn't breathe. The most intense fear he'd ever felt in his life, gripping all through his chest, sending tendrils around his heart. Harry Potter, who had remained untouched, silently guided his broomstick toward the ground, and then leapt off to stand between Draco and the seething outline, interposing himself like a living shield.
"Run!"
said Harry Potter, turning his head half back to look at Draco. The silver moonlight gleamed on his face.
"Run, Draco! I'll hold it off!"
"You can't fight that thing alone!" Draco cried aloud.
A nausea was in his stomach, a churning sensation that, looking back in memory, seemed both like and unlike a sense of guilt, as though it had the sensations, but not quite all of the emotion.
"I must,"
Harry Potter said grimly.
"Go!" "Harry, I'm sorry for everything. I..."
Though later, looking back, Draco couldn't quite remember what he'd meant to apologize for. Maybe it had been that he was planning to overthrow Harry's conspiracy all that time ago. The seething figure, now seeming blacker and more terrible, rose up into the air, hovering off the ground.
"Go!"
shouted Harry. Draco turned and fled headlong into the woods, with the branches whipping at his face. Behind him, Draco heard another terrible hiss and Harry's voice rising, crying something that Draco couldn't make out from the distance. Draco turned his head for only an instant to look back, and in that moment ran into something, hitting his head hard, and blacked out. Harry held a tight grip on his wand, a prismatic sphere glowing around him. He stared levelly at the seething, blurring form in front of him, and said,
"What on earth are you doing?"
The seething blurs resolved, reformed, relaxed back into a hooded form. Whatever concealment had been at work, a device rather than a charm, Harry guessed, since the magic had been able to affect him, had prevented his mind from recognizing the shape, or even that the shape was human. But it hadn't prevented Harry from recognizing the sharp sense of doom. Professor Quirrell stood straight, with silver blood all down the front of his enshrouding black cloak, and gave a sigh, looking at the fallen forms of three auras, Tracy Davis, Draco Malfoy, and Professor McGonagall.
"I had honestly thought," Professor Quirrell murmured, "that I jammed that mirror without alarm. What were two first-year Slytherins doing alone in the Forbidden Forest? Mr. Malfoy has more sense than this. What a fiasco.
Harry didn't answer. The sense of doom was as strong as Harry could ever remember feeling it, a feeling of power in the air so great that it was almost tangible. Some part of him was still viscerally shocked at how fast the shield surrounding the auras had been torn apart. He almost hadn't been able to see the successive lashes of colour which had torn away the shields like tissue paper. It made the duel Professor Quirrell had fought against the aura in Azkaban look like a mockery, a child's game. Though, Professor Quirrell had claimed then that if he had fought for real, the aura would have been dead in seconds. And Harry now knew that this was also true. Just how high did the power ladder go?
"I take it," Harry said, managing to keep his voice steady, "that your eating unicorns has something to do with why you'll get fired from the defense professor position. I don't suppose you'd care to explain in considerable detail."
Professor Quirrell looked at him. The almost tangible sense of power in the air seemed to diminish, drawing back into the defense professor.
"I shall indeed explain myself," the defense professor said. "I need to cast a few memory charms first, and then we may go off and discuss it, for it would not be wise for me to stay. You will return to this time later, as I know."
Harry willed himself to be able to see through the cloak he had mastered,